It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The average price of a gallon of gas in Wisconsin has ticked well over $4 a gallon as the conflict between the U.S. and Iran threatens to raise the price of gas near record highs.
The fuel price tracking site GasBuddy lists the average gallon of gas in Wisconsin at $4.25 a gallon.
Estimates from AAA rate the state's prices around 50 cents higher per gallon than a month ago, more than a dollar higher per gallon than this time last year.
To break down the latest on rising gas prices, we have Nick Jarmus with us, Public Affairs Director for AAA. Nick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Good morning.
How do gas prices look across Wisconsin right now? What do you see?
Well, as you said, our statewide average is about $4.23, and that's up 40 cents just in the last week. And as you said, it's about $1.25 higher than it was at this time last year.
And you said Wisconsin may break the state's record, a high of $4.92 per gallon from June 2022. What would have to happen for us to go to those types of prices?
Well, it's possible, and it's really more about what would not happen in order to avoid that, I think, at this point. I think it's a safe bet to say that we have not seen the highest prices yet. Whether or not we will get to those record highs again really depends on finding some solution to the impasse in the Strait of Hormuz. Demand is going to continue to go up as we head into the summer driving, road trip season. Even if we get these refinery issues that have been kind of pushing the regional prices in the Midwest up a little bit resolved, there still needs to be something to take that upward pressure off of the oil market. And without that, we very possibly could see a return to those record high prices.
Tell us more there. What's going on with these refinery disruptions in the Midwest?
Yeah, so there were several refineries in the Illinois, Indiana region and southern end of Lake Michigan, which supplies most of the gas that is purchased in the eastern part of Wisconsin, as well as most of Illinois and Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio. And several of those refineries have had either maintenance issues or some sort of issue that has reduced their output in the last week, even temporarily. And there's just such a volatile market for that spec gas going out into the stations that any sort of disruption in that supply chain can push prices up. And so we've seen the gap between Wisconsin's statewide average and the national average narrow from about 30 cents to just 15 cents in the last week, largely because of that.
So certainly a sensitive area there when those refineries even temporarily go offline. Looking at gas stations in particular, a gas station manager in Milwaukee told WISN yesterday that they've received pushback from customers as prices at the pump have rapidly climbed higher. Do individual gas stations have much latitude in setting their fuel prices?
They have some, but, first and foremost, Wisconsin does have a minimum markup law that it says that they have to sell gas at a certain percentage above the wholesale price that they pay for it. And that's an old Depression era law that was meant to, keep larger chains from squeezing out smaller local competition by undercutting them, and absorbing the loss and then driving them out of business and then jacking up prices. There's, considerable debate whether that law is really accomplishing what it's doing or really necessary, but it is a reality that that law is on the books. So those station owners are needing to price at, that 9% above what they're paying for wholesale. And that does really tie their hands a little bit in Wisconsin compared to some other states.
We're approaching that, busy summer travel road trip season. How much do rising gas prices actually affect whether people keep or cancel travel plans?
Historically, it doesn't really affect their travel plans when it comes to these big summer road trips that they plan for and look forward to all year. We've referenced the record high prices we saw in 2022. And even that summer, we saw a year-over-year increase in the number of people traveling for Memorial Day and Independence Day. What you may see is more day-to-day, people trying to avoid trips or combine trips. But when it comes to planning those big road trips, the gas bill is actually probably one of the smallest parts of the budget for a road trip. And it's something that people will, try to compensate for by cutting costs in other areas, maybe staying at a less expensive hotel, doing more fast food or packing their own food instead of stopping at sit-down restaurants, things like that to defray the cost that they're seeing at the pump.
Nick, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Nick Jarmus, Public Affairs Director for AAA. Now for more on the broader economic impacts of rising gas prices, we turn to Logan Kelly, Chair of the Department of Economics and a professor at UW-River Falls. Logan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
One of the longer-term risks of rising fuel prices is this risk of elevated inflation as the year progresses and the war drags on. Why is that the case?
Well, a big story here is the rising gas price, but a hidden, even bigger story is really the price of diesel, because diesel is what powers the tractors that the farmers use to the trucks that bring all of the goods to the store where we find them. So while most consumers are going to pay the gas price at the pump, they're going to pay the diesel price in the grocery store. And so what we see is something that in economics we refer to as a negative or a unfavorable supply shock. And that's kind of a really technical term for essentially saying we increase the cost of some input that just spreads throughout the entire economy. Oil touches every good that we work with in the economy through, if nothing else, transportation. And as a result, that leads to what we call this cost push inflation. And it touches a lot of things. We can all go all the way over to interest rates because these kinds of unfavorable supply shocks puts the Federal Reserve in a very, very difficult position. They're between the rock of higher inflation because we have this cost push inflation and the hard place of a slowing economy.
And of course, on Wednesday, we did see Chair Jerome Powell expressing caution around what he described as uncertainty about the U.S. economy holding interest rates steady. Could then inflation pressures lead to an interest rate hike? What do you see?
I wouldn't predict an interest rate hike in the near future, as in, say, maybe the next meeting. Generally speaking, right now, when we're in this kind of economic condition, the idea is hold steady. All right, just kind of stay the same. And we've seen that in what the Fed has responded with in a steady holding of the interest rates. They haven't really changed a lot. But we're also seeing other forces coming in when we start looking at, say, for example, the labor market. Mm-hmm. While we're not seeing layoffs or a real degrading of the labor market as it stands, we are starting to see some at the margins where we're looking at those who are looking for a job now are finding it much more difficult to find one. And so we're starting to see these signs of a slowing economy, which is what sparked the guidance that we need to be cautious that the economy may be starting to slow.
And the price shock at the gas pump seems to be in stark contrast to this exuberance of stock investors right now. I mean, markets soaring. What is this moment like for a Wisconsinite who doesn't have an investment portfolio and has to drive to and from work?
Well, you've really hit on an important point here. This increase in fuel costs, and if we look at energy prices, in the month of March alone, we had a 10% increase, actually almost 11% increase in overall energy prices. This disproportionately hits lower income members of the economy. So it's disproportionately affecting the bottom 40% of the economy. And so when we really look at, well, what's driving some of the stock booms, what's driving some of the continued increase in GDP, We're seeing that in very isolated areas. For example, we're seeing a significant amount of business investment, particularly surrounding AI. And that business investment is pushing up some of the GDP numbers, even when we're starting to see other parts of the economy start to become softer.
So broadening out beyond Wisconsin here, states like Georgia, Utah, and Indiana, in addition to several congressional senators, have implemented or proposed gas tax holidays to temporarily cut prices at the pump. Could this work in Wisconsin?
So it's really a band-aid type patch for a longer run issue. The issue is we are having supply chain issues within the supply of gasoline. Supply of gasoline, supply of oil, supply of diesel. All of these things are being disrupted. We can lower taxes, but what will happen is eventually that gives us a short run relief to the price of the gas pump, but eventually those prices move back up if we don't reestablish the supply. And then we end up with lower gas, with the same high gas price, with the same without the gas tax.
So Strait of Hormuz blocked since effectively March 2nd. Would prices come back down if the conflict between the U.S. and Iran in the strait is resolved?
Well, not immediately. And we may see a reduction in the price of gas or in particular goods. Generally, though, we don't see a reduction in overall prices. We may see a reduction in inflation, which is the growth rate of prices, but we don't usually see the overall price level go down. So the real wealth effect of the inflation that occurred. So basically, the reduction in spending power that's associated with our savings and income that occurred over this period is generally permanent. We don't generally see deflation to balance out the inflation. But if the supply chain does resume, it is reasonable to expect that at least fuel prices should start to come back down to a more long-run equilibrium.
Logan, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you.
Logan Kelly chairs the Department of Economics at UW-River Falls. Earlier, we talked with Nick Jarmus at AAA about the wartime high of oil prices and how it affects Wisconsin households and the broader economy.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, primary election campaigns are getting crowded on the Democratic side of the ballot for this year's midterm elections. Our politics team gets us up to speed in this week's edition of Inside Wisconsin Politics from WPR and PBS Wisconsin. That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. It might feel like there's a lull in Wisconsin politics right now, but behind the scenes, politicians from both parties are gearing up for the party primaries on August 11th and the general election on November 3rd.
Democrats are aggressively jumping into primary races, crowding the Democratic field for governor and several congressional seats. They're hopeful that this will be a favorable year for them, while Republicans are looking to defend their legislative majorities.
That is on the table in this week's edition of Inside Wisconsin Politics. Joining the discussion are WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
So before we get started with some specific examples here, I want to start with why this kind of caught our attention. And for me, it's because in the very recent past, you had Democrats and liberals very wary about jumping into primaries. What's changed, Zach?
I think the biggest thing that's changed is the Democrats see more opportunity to win some of these. Over the past 16 years, basically in the Scott Walker era on, when the maps didn't favor Wisconsin and perhaps the political climate didn't favor candidates statewide, there was a concern that a primary just took up too many resources that were limited, mainly money and time, and the threat that if they went negative against each other, it really hurt their opportunity to win statewide. Since Democrats have gotten on a roll and won a lot of these races for governor, AG, state Supreme Court, and they've got better maps, they see more opportunity, and so there's more options for people to get in because the primary doesn't look quite as devastating.
You know, for me, as I was thinking about this, I almost feel like it's directly related to whatever the national political situation is at the time. So we are right now in the Trump midterm. Where were we a few years ago in the Biden midterm? You had Democrats jumping out of a primary for Senate, clearing the way for Mandela Barnes. Where were we in the first Trump midterm in 2018? You had about a dozen Democrats running for governor that year, and on and on and on. I think it's kind of a really simple flow chart. Is it a midterm? Yes. Is your president in the White House? No. Well, in that case, you're probably going to want to jump into a primary and give a chance for your party. Anya, let's jump into one of these specific examples this week. And you know, I want to characterize this as the opportunity knocks kind of a Democratic primary in the first congressional district where we have Representative Brian Steil, a Republican, is seen as a pretty strong candidate. The district leans Republican. And yet this week we had a Democratic candidate say, hey, it's not too late for me to jump in. Tell us about what happened.
Yeah, I mean, there have been several Democrats that have been running for quite a while, but none of them have really been a clear front runner. None of them have raised a significant amount of money. Brian Steil, by contrast, is a very good campaigner and a very good fundraiser. He has quite a lot in his war chest. And so there had been some rumblings that this alder person from Milwaukee was going to jump in, and he did, Peter Bergelis. He is currently a sitting member of the Milwaukee Council. He does not live in the district, and so him coming out, it's really interesting because he's essentially saying, I am the person who can get the national money that is required to flip this district. He's trying to make the argument that it is more flippable than Democrats think. It is considered of Wisconsin's kind of two-ish congressional districts, the safer one for Republicans. But he's saying if we can get money, we can get in the game.
Rich, you've been following this district for a while now. Why would Peter Bergelis look at the field here and say, you know, why not me?
Well, exactly what Anya said. So Steil, here's an example of how good of a fundraiser he is. He's currently sitting on more than $5.5 million in his campaign war chest. And during the first 3 months of the year, he raised more money than any, he spent more money than any Democrat even raised. So maybe Bergelis is thinking, I'll get that Democratic money, etc. But to the point that this is an interesting district because on paper it is competitive, but Steil has just been a powerhouse and he's easily defeated every Democrat that has come up against him. So I don't know if this is enough of a Democratic wavier potentially that it could make it a little closer, but it seems like Democrats think it's worth a shot.
Zach, can somebody come in from outside of a district, and very prominently outside of a district, too? I mean, he holds elected office outside the district. Can you come in and say, I want to be your congressman?
Well, running outside the district is not uncommon at all in Wisconsin. You don't need to live in the district. You're only supposed to live there by the time you would take office. So he doesn't even have to set up residence there in order to campaign there, even if he does win the nomination. That's not uncommon. It is a matter of winning a primary if you don't live there, because there he has to convince the voters in that district that he should be the Democrat to represent them against Steil in the fall. And that is a little bit of a tougher ask. That is him saying, I'm the one that's different from the rest of these that you haven't really coalesced around in the past. And this would represent more of trying to bring in national attention, but it would require a national wave to upset Steil in this district. When you look at district congressional seats in Wisconsin, the national Dems didn't even invest into the third, which is a much closer district in past races. They didn't come close to investing in the first. And so it would require a completely different landscape for national money to really come in from the Democratic Party to say, we see the first is in play.
It could be a case of they just want Brian Steil to spend his money and not have that sitting around for a future election, too.
That makes a big difference.
Let's move on to another primary. And since I'm naming stuff today, I'm going to call this one the Opportunity Knox. No, we did the Opportunity Knox primary. I need to get my name straight if I'm going to do this. This is the Don't Tell Me What to Do primary, an important distinction in Democratic primaries. We've got a couple examples here today. Let's start with one in the 3rd Congressional District, Rich. I've heard a lot about this district because it's our most competitive congressional district. Derek Van Orden is the Republican incumbent. I've heard a lot about Rebecca Cook, the Democratic challenger who has outraised him recently and seems to be getting a lot of attention. There is a primary there. Well, who's running? Mm-hmm.
So the primary is between Cook, who's an Eau Claire Democrat raised on a dairy farm in the county and, you know, has done some political consulting work, fundraising work for Democrats in years past, but now she's back. She's really portraying herself as kind of the district, you know, born and bred Wisconsin, et cetera. Republicans are trying to, you know, focus the attention on her consulting work, et cetera. The other Democrat is longtime Eau Claire City Council member, former council president until just recently, Emily Berge of Eau Claire. And she's portraying herself as the grassroots choice in this race. And National Democrats came in and started sending resources, staff, et cetera, back in February to Cook's campaign. And Berge said, well, that's pretty dirty, you know. She essentially said D.C. shouldn't be deciding who is the Democrat to face Van Orden. It should be the people of Eau Claire. And just anecdotally, when I'm walking through the city, I don't see a lot of Cook signs. In fact, I don't remember seeing any, but I see a whole bunch of Berge signs. So this being one of the more, if not the most populous areas in the 3rd District, maybe that makes a difference. But in terms of resources, Cook is way, way, way ahead of Berge in all the fundraising reports that I've seen.
Zach, do you get the sense that this is, you know, a competitive primary here?
It could be. It really depends on how much the primary voters pay attention. And that's always the issue in some of these primaries is name recognition makes a big deal. That's why the National Party comes in and puts resources behind Cook. It's not necessarily that they like her more. It's they think she has the better chance to win in the fall and get her moving now. It's the old mentality we talked about at the beginning of the show of why didn't Democrats do primaries in the past. It takes resources. It can get ugly. It can get negative. It could hurt the candidate going into the fall. I ran into Berge when she was campaigning with Francesca Hong for governor in La Crosse. They were doing an event at the same bookstore, and it's not a coincidence. And while we were talking to them, they were talking about going and seeing them at the next stop. And there is a kind of thematic fit with that campaign of more grassroots, more from the bottom up, and running against party types who tell us who our candidate should be. Parties like to dictate sometimes who the candidate can be so they can focus resources. Sometimes that does run up against a wall, which is why your title for this, Don't Tell Me What to Do, does fit, because there are candidates who are going to say, no, let the people decide. People have to pay attention, though.
All right. We've got another Don't Tell Me What to Do primary, Anya. This is in one of the state Senate districts that we're watching that could determine control of the Wisconsin State Senate this year, the 17th state Senate district. Howard Markline is the Republican incumbent, and the Democratic Party had been sending strong signals that they knew who they wanted to run for a while now. And yet, there's a candidate who says, I want to run too. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Jenna Jacobson, who currently serves in the Assembly, has been sort of the anointed Democratic choice to run against Howard Markline for this district, which also has been redrawn in a way that could be more favorable for Democrats. So Markline's sort of on his heels in that way. But then yesterday, we got the announcement that Corrine Hendrickson, who, if you have written an article or read an article about childcare advocacy in the last 3 years, you have heard that name. She has been at the Capitol. She was a small business owner, a daycare owner in New Glarus. That was very much her issue. And now she's running for office. So a political newcomer, somebody with this kind of particular set of policy expectations and preferences, challenging a fellow Democrat. And so that is it caught our attention for that reason that it's a competitive district. It's not safe for Democrats. So here's somebody coming in and saying, I want to throw my hat in and I want to advocate for my specific approach to politics.
And you know, I do feel like we have this debate about primaries pretty much every single primary about whether it's going to help or hurt the candidates. I think they are making a bet this year that they can afford to have those debates. And the argument for it helping them is that they are going to kind of dominate the news cycle for a little while in August and get more attention than candidates that don't have a primary. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us.
That was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org.
And if you have questions that you want the Inside Politics team to want tackle, especially during this election season, let us know about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, meet your neighbors and fix your stuff. Community groups around the state are hosting repair clubs where volunteers help fix everything from clothing to furniture to appliances. Visit two communities and find out how it works.
You get paired up with someone to help fix your items, and it's a great time to connect and feel a deeper connection to your community.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. If you're doing some spring cleaning this time of year, you might run into things that don't work quite like they should. The bike that needs fixing, summer clothes that need mending, appliances you're hanging on to because they might work again with a little TLC.
You may not know how to fix them yourself or when to take them for repair, but communities around the state are stepping up to help with repair clubs.
Sometimes called repair cafes or fix-it groups, they're community efforts that provide volunteer expertise and access to tools. A listener in Viroqua emailed us about a fix-it club he started there. In a quick online count, I found another dozen communities that have hosted repair events around the state.
We're checking in now with some of the organizers of these events.
We'll start in Stevens Point with the Fix-It Clinic, scheduled for tomorrow from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Commons Community Nonprofit Center. Susan Schuler is Executive Director of Recycling Connections in Stevens Point, and Kara Kugi is a UW-Stevens Point student on the planning team for the Community Fix-It Clinic. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us. We're happy to be here.
Yep.
And Susan, spell out to us what happens at one of these repair club events like your Fix-It Clinic in Stevens Point.
Yeah, we're really excited to be hosting our Fix-It Clinic. What happens at this event is we pair fixers up with residents or people that have broken items, and they bring them in to be paired up with a fixer to help us out. You know, it's a community event in that way, pairing our fixers with items that are broken to keep them from landfill and help people learn a little bit more about how to fix common items maybe they have hanging around so they can extend the life of items instead of landfilling and replacing.
Kara, as a student there at Point, what made you want to get involved in this project?
Well, it's part of our senior thesis project for our class, but it's just super interesting. It's great to get the community involved in what we're learning in our classes and applying that. So it's just a really cool opportunity.
Susan, what kind of Fix-It volunteers have signed up? What kind of people are there to help people fix their stuff?
We're really lucky. We have some great volunteers lined up. We have a general fixer with woodworking and general handyman. We have a mender who's coming in to help fix and sew and all of those items. We have a bike fixer that's going to be there, and a computer person that can help with general maintenance of your computers.
Kara, I think a lot of our society is geared toward buying a thing, using it till it goes away, and then throwing it away, whether we're talking about clothes or tools or whatever. Has participating in this and then being a part of the event on the weekend, does that change the way you think about our stuff?
It definitely has. I think a lot of our coursework as well in our class really like hones down on that kind of attitude that our society has. So it's really like made me second guess like things that I might purchase or ways that maybe I have acted in that way in the past, and kind of try to change that.
And Kara, has this made you interested in learning how to fix things yourself?
Oh, definitely. I'm hoping I can kind of watch some of the fixers and try to learn some of my own skills from that.
And Susan, talk a little bit about this as a community event. What do you think, what do you hope that this does for people in Stevens Point and the surrounding area?
To help them understand how to fix items, repair simple things, some skills or tools you might want to have around in your house to aid in that assistance to fix things and keep them from landfill. It also creates some problem-solving skills. We don't know what we're going to get at these fix-it clinics. And it creates some creativity of our fixers of how to problem solve and fix items as they come in.
Kara, I gotta ask, are you planning to bring anything to get fixed yourself?
Unfortunately, I don't have anything on campus that could be fixed. I live in the dorms right now, but I did have some stuff at home I should have brought back.
And Susan, people may be hearing this and thinking, well, I want to participate either in this next event or get involved in the future. What are some ways that people can get involved in this kind of activity?
Recycling Connections is trying to host these. If this event goes well, we want to make it habit perhaps once or twice a year. So we have a website, recyclingconnections.org, that we post all of our events and opportunities like this on that site. And our mission is to help keep things from landfills and recycle right and compost. So we have a lot of waste reduction opportunities that we promote. And this is just one of them that we're adding to the mix of events that we offer as a nonprofit.
Yeah. What else? What's coming up next apart from the Fix-It Clinic that can help people not waste their stuff?
Yeah, so it's going to be International Compost Awareness Week next week. And so we have a webinar on backyard composting that people can get involved in. And then come fall, we're going to be talking about pumpkins and how you can keep pumpkins out of the landfill and make sure that you compost them at our Pumpkin Smash community event. And that's coming up in November. So those are just a few little teasers for what's coming that people can get involved in our community.
And Kara, does this experience have you interested in sustainability after you're done with that class, after you're done with college?
Yeah, I'm a wastewater treatment is what I plan on going into with my major. So I think it'll just help me be more aware with that and the way that I'm living, being more sustainable. I want to start a compost one day in a garden. So just super interesting how you can apply it to your life.
Thank you both so much for sharing this with us.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Susan Schuler with Recycling Connections and Kara Kugi, a UW-Stevens Point student. We've been talking about the Community Fix-It Clinic in Stevens Point. That's coming up tomorrow at 11. Now we'll turn to a project in La Crosse called the Repair Cafe. Livy Hackbarth is lifelong learning librarian at the La Crosse Public Library, and Natalie Hennigan is Community Outreach Director for Habitat for Humanity of the Greater La Crosse Region. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Now, this is an event that's been going on and off anyway in La Crosse for some time now. Can you share a little bit about your event there, the Repair Cafe? Livy, let's start with you.
Yeah, we've been doing this for, I think, about 2 years now. It might be a little bit longer. I might be wrong on that. But so it's basically a drop-in event. We do it on a Saturday so that folks who may work during the week can come in. It's a great accessible time for folks. You drop in between 10:30 and 12:30 when we have this event. Bring your items. You can bring as many as you want. And yeah, you get paired up with someone to help fix your items and chat with other community members that show up. It's a great time to connect and feel a deeper connection to your community.
And Natalie, what kind of Fix-It volunteers have shown up there in La Crosse?
Sure. So we focused on mending and sewing, small electrical repairs, carpentry, so a lot of furniture repairs, and then some jewelry repair as well.
Wow. Livy, I understand this is part of a wider sharing economy program you have at the La Crosse Library. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. So we've got a tool library, which is very cool. I think we have over 200 items that you're able to check out at the library. So things from like KitchenAid mixers, we have gardening tools, we have a lawnmower. We have so many different items that you can, share across the community. So people don't have to buy these items for themselves. We can, share this tool that you may only use once or twice a year. So yeah, we've got a lot of good stuff in that library.
And Natalie, how do you see this connecting to your wider mission at Habitat for Humanity?
Sure. So at Habitat, of course, we build and rehab affordable homes and ensure that the home buyers and families we work with lock in an affordable mortgage. But we also know that affordability has to last long before you move into a house. So how you are able to repair your home, repair your stuff in an affordable manner, that's all part and parcel of our mission. So we love partnering with the library on this and many other events and activities. And it was a natural extension of our mission. We also could tap into our phenomenal core of volunteers who help build and repair Habitat homes, and lots of them have the knowledge they're able to share at the repair cafes.
Livy, what kind of response have you gotten from the community, not just the volunteers, but are people showing up for these, and what kind of things are they saying about these events?
Yeah, we've gotten a great response to these events. We have about like 20-ish people come per time, and people always asking when the next event is. There's always people who bring multiple items. And so the amount of things that we get fixed during this like short 2-hour period is quite phenomenal. So yeah, like Natalie said, things from like toasters to lamps to yard decor, people just really appreciate being able to come in and get their items fixed. It is always something that we are talking about with folks. It's really exciting.
Now, Natalie, I poked around online. I found about a dozen groups like this in the state, Repair Cafe, Repair Club, Fix-It Clinic, different names. If somebody out there is listening saying, hey, we don't have this in our community, what would you suggest to them to get the ball rolling and to create something like this?
Sure. Well, first of all, find a couple partners. So again, Habitat partnering up with the library was a really logical choice because we were able to combine the library's space and access to tools with Habitat's access to volunteers and experts. Plus, we also bring a cart of tools from the Habitat Restore. So I think there are 20-some Habitats and Habitat Restores in the state of Wisconsin. I think it's an excellent way to partner with a local Habitat. Again, tapping into the volunteers we work with, the tools and materials we have access to at the Restore. But a public library or community center that has the space that's an easy to access, you know, centrally located space is also a great or a needed piece, I think, of the puzzle.
That's a great place to leave it. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Livy Hackbarth with the La Crosse Public Library and Natalie Hennigan with Habitat for Humanity of the Greater La Crosse Region talking about their Repair Cafe. Earlier we heard about the Fix-It Clinic. That's tomorrow in Stevens Point. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Our managing producer is Tim Peterson.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.